From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we take a look at the historical forces that shaped Iraq with Charles Tripp, author of A History of Iraq. We'll talk about how Iraq became a nation, how Saddam Hussein became its strongman, and what the United States will likely face if it overthrows him. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Diaspora Blues, the new CD by trumpeter and composer Stephen Bernstein. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle lashed out at President Bush today on the floor of the Senate, accusing him of using Iraq for political purposes. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Daschle took to the floor of the Senate after reading published remarks by the president, who characterized the democratically run Senate as not interested in the security of the American people. Daschle called the remark outrageous.
The president ought to apologize to Senator Inouye and every veteran who has fought in every war who is a Democrat in the United States Senate. He ought to apologize to the American people.
Daschle said war with Iraq ought not be politicized, but Senate Minority Leader Trent Lott then chided his colleague for criticizing the president.
Who is the enemy here? The president of the United States or Saddam Hussein?
It's not clear what effect the war of words will have on bipartisan efforts to come up with a resolution on Iraq. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Palestinian officials say a planned meeting with Israeli negotiators has been canceled. The two sides were to have discussed ways to end the siege of Yasser Arafat's headquarters in Ramallah. Palestinians say they called off the meeting after Israel refused to allow foreign officials into Arafat's compound. Israel has said it won't withdraw its troops from the nearly demolished compound until Arafat hands over 19 men it says are wanted on suspicion of terrorism. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres said today that the siege will also continue because Palestinians are still attacking Israelis. On Capitol Hill, the House has approved a bill that would make it easier for health care providers and insurers to decline to offer or provide coverage of abortions. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
The House passed the Abortion Non-Discrimination Act by a vote of 229 to 189. As usual in abortion debates, backers and foes disagreed on its impact. Abortion opponents said it would clarify existing conscience clause protections. Such laws allow individuals and institutions to decline to provide abortions based on moral or religious convictions. Backers also said it's needed to combat efforts by abortion rights groups to require religious hospitals to provide abortion services when they merge with non-religious providers. But abortion rights supporters said the bill is so sweeping, it would block states from enforcing laws requiring that victims of rape or incest be given access to abortions. And they said that insurance plans might opt not to cover abortions for economic rather than moral reasons. Julie Rovner, NPR News, The Capitol.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 158 points, or 2.1%, to close at 7,841 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 40 points, or 3.4%. It closed at 1,222. This is NPR News. House and Senate negotiators are reported to be close to a compromise on energy legislation. Representative Billy Tozan, who's leading the negotiations, said the compromise bill could include drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. The Louisiana Republican said any compromise on drilling in the refuge would reduce the size of the project to protect the environment. Tozan spoke to reporters after a meeting today with President Bush. Sales of existing homes fell somewhat in August. That's according to a report from the National Association of Realtors. The association blamed the drop on weakness in the economy. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The association said nearly 5.3 million previously owned homes were sold during August. That is still a healthy number in historical terms, but it represents a drop of 1.7% from the month before. David LeRae is the association's chief economist.
It's clear that the boom that we experienced in housing for the first half of this year is over, and the housing markets are now cooling down a bit to more sustainable levels of activity.
LaRae said the drop was something of a surprise because interest rates remain at their lowest levels in at least 30 years. LaRae said sales dropped in the Midwest, Northeast, and the South, but were up somewhat in the West. He also said one reason for the decline may be consumer worries about the impending war with Iraq. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
People along the Louisiana coast are bracing for heavy rains when Tropical Storm Isidore reaches land sometime after midnight. Forecasters say New Orleans could get as much as 15 inches of rain. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Charles Tripp, is an expert on the past and present of Iraq. We asked him to help us understand the long dictatorship of Saddam Hussein and to assess how Iraq and the Gulf region might be changed if we go to war against Iraq. Tripp is a senior lecturer in the Department of Political Studies at the University of London. He's the author of books about the Iran-Iraq War and Saudi Arabia. His book, A History of Iraq, has been published in a new updated edition. Let's start with the creation of Iraq by the British government. During World War I, Britain invaded and occupied three provinces of the Ottoman Empire, Basra, Baghdad, and Mosul. In 1920, the League of Nations combined these three separate provinces into the State of Iraq and authorized the British to administer it. This new state brought together different populations, including Shia Muslims, Sunni Muslims, and Kurds, and created for the first time an Iraqi national and political identity. I asked Charles Tripp about the problems the British faced in trying to hold this new nation together.
Well, there were two major kinds of problems. One was the fundamental question that many of the people who now found themselves within this new state of Iraq had never actually had to live and work together. And therefore, the idea of working with an Iraqi state was quite a new idea. And many of them were quite apprehensive, I think, not simply by the fact that people hostile to themselves might be controlling that state, whether they be the British or the British clients in Iraq itself, but also the whole notion of working within a modern state, having to abide by regulations, boundaries, taxation systems, conscription systems, all the apparatus of a modern state that many people in Iraq found deeply repulsive.
What kind of debate went on within Iraq about what Iraqi identity was?
Well, there was a big struggle in many ways to define what identity the Iraqis had. So one of the natural tendencies was for the people who actually had control of the state, who were largely from the Sunni Arab population, largely Ottoman civil servants and army officers, tended to think that what they said was Iraqi would be Iraqi. But that was challenged both by the Kurds in the north, who believed that Iraqi nationality, insofar as it developed, should not be simply dominated by the Arabs. And it was often challenged by the Shia of the south, who didn't, many of them, believe in a single national secular identity, but saw themselves more as part of a Muslim community.
When did Britain give up the mandate of Iraq, and when did Iraq get its independence?
Well, Iraq was the first of the League of Nations mandate states to become independent in 1932. The British had decided quite early on that there was no need to be an imperial power in a very detailed sense in Iraq, that is, administering every aspect of the Iraqi state. Rather, they should exercise what came to be called informal empire in Iraq. That is, influence over the government, military basing rights, but beyond that, largely granting the Iraqis their independence. So after 1932, Iraq was formally independent. There was still, of course, a large measure of British influence and British power there, but it was certainly independent earlier than any of the other Arab states.
What happened after Iraq got its independence? How did its own national politics start to take shape?
Well, one of the things that became apparent quite quickly was the fact that the British had installed a monarchy in Iraq, because that's the way the British at the time thought that you would bring a certain degree of cohesion. And they'd chosen as the monarch a member of the Hashemite family from the Hejaz in Arabia, who had been very instrumental in the Arab revolt. And King Faisal I, the first king of Iraq, was a man of extraordinary authority and, battling against great odds, both against the British and against the Iraqis, managed to forge something like a national sense of loyalty to him. But he died a year after independence. And then you had his much weaker son, and his son died in a car crash a few years later, and then his infant child. So the monarchy was in Iraq, but increasingly troubled, increasingly at odds with various factions of the Iraqi population. And one of the things that became apparent very quickly in the 1930s was the role of the army in Iraqi politics, that is, the importance of the army officers in deciding who should govern the country. And just as Iraq became the first of the League of Nations mandates to become independent in 1932, it was also the first of the Arab states to suffer what one came to think of as a classical military coup d'etat in 1936, which led to a whole succession of coups and counter-coups up until 1941.
And what happened in 41?
Well, in 1941, the Second World War was raging, and the people who were coming out on top in Iraqi politics increasingly believed that the British Empire was about to be defeated by the axis of Germany and Italy in Europe and North Africa, and rather unwisely sided with the Axis powers, at the same time seeking to defy British demands to send increasing troops through the Middle East via Iraq. And that led to a brief war with Great Britain in 1941, whereby the British invaded, recaptured Baghdad, and reinstated the monarchy.
And how long did the monarchy last?
Well, until 1958, when, again, a military coup d'etat by Revolutionary Army officers swept aside the monarchy, killing most of the ruling family and establishing the Iraqi Republic.
And how did the Iraqi Republic compare to what had gone before?
In some ways, the Iraqi Republic wasn't very different to the Iraqi monarchy. And I think this is one of the features that one has to take into account when looking at Iraqi history, is that whether under monarchy or under republic, one of the features was the very centralized authoritarian state, the importance of the army in that state, the lack of truly representative life, and the increasing importance of oil income. These are all features of the republic, as they were increasingly of the monarchy under the Hashemite monarchs.
If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Charles Tripp. He has a new edition of his book, A History of Iraq. Let's jump ahead to when Saddam Hussein assumes power in Iraq in July of 1979. How did he assume power in Iraq?
Well, in 1979, Saddam Hussein became president of the republic formally, but effectively he had been the strongman, as it was called, of the regime for some years before. In 1968, there had been a military coup d'etat engineered by the Ba'ath Party, of which he was an activist. And the president of Iraq after the coup d'etat became someone called Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr, a cousin of Saddam Hussein, and in many ways his protector, his patron within Iraqi politics. And it was under his protection that Saddam Hussein increasingly became the power in the state from the early 1970s onwards. In 1979, it's been, I think, quite convincingly argued that he pushed Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr aside, and Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr retired on grounds of ill health, and Saddam Hussein became president.
He was 42 at the time. You say he acted swiftly and ruthlessly to eliminate all those whom he felt would not give him unquestioning obedience. How did he do that?
Well, for the 2 years before he became president, he had made sure that he had disposed of many of those who had supported the Ba'athist government but were not very enthusiastic about Saddam Hussein. In other words, people who had joined the Ba'ath Party, which was an Arab National Socialist Party, either because they were socialists and believed in a view of a socialist development path for Iraq, or because they were Arab nationalists. And for Saddam Hussein, these people, although useful at a certain stage in Iraqi politics, were quite dangerous to him because they effectively pursued a vision of Iraq which wasn't his. He was not a socialist, and some would argue that he's not particularly an Arab nationalist if it contradicts his own pursuit of power and security. So these people were dangerous, and effectively he did it by a number of conspiracies. There was the communist conspiracy, so-called, of 1978, whereby many of the leftists in the party were purged, killed, arrested, disappeared. And in 1979, there was the so-called Syrian conspiracy, where many of the Arab nationalists in the party were equally disposed of through denunciations, arrests, and executions.
When Saddam Hussein took over Iraq, it was, as it still is, a country of divided religions and ethnic backgrounds, causing a lot of conflicts of every sort within the state. You say he sought to build political unity within Iraq by uniting people behind his own personality cult. So instead of uniting around like a larger Iraqi identity or Arab identity or religious identity, it was the Saddam identity that everybody was supposed to rally around. How did he manage to do that, or try to do that? We'll see how well he succeeded.
I think he succeeded in it through two well-tried techniques, which the Iraqis call intimidation and co-option. In other words, he terrorized people so that he made it quite clear that if you were not with him, you were against him. And the price of being against him was very severe: death, torture, expulsion, arrest, and even at its most mild level, the stunting of your career prospects and making it clear to you that you would get nowhere. But however, if you were for him, if, in other words, you mouthed all the things that he held true at the time, if you followed the party line as he dictated it, then you found yourself on an upward moving escalator of rewards, privileges, favors, which bound you to the person of Saddam Hussein, but also made you, in a sense, a collaborator in his venture and separated you off from other people. So he has been an extraordinarily astute operator within Iraqi politics, knowing whom to favor, whom to disfavor, at what time. And the fact that he survived so long in Iraqi politics is a testimony to his skill at manipulating this particular form of coercion and co-option.
What are some of the things Saddam Hussein has emphasized in his version of Iraqi identity?
There are two things, I think, that come out quite clearly in his depiction of Iraqi nationalism, Iraqi national identity. One is very strongly this idea that Iraq is a 5,000-year-old nation. In other words, making up for the fact that Iraq is an invention of the British in the 20th century, to try and root Iraqis, give them a sense of place in history, a sense of purpose, a sense of unity in that way. And he's been very keen to try and emphasize this historical rootedness of the Iraqi people. I think partly that comes out of a concern by Saddam Hussein, which is he's not alone, I think, in feeling that Iraq was a creation of imperial powers and it may one day be uncreated by imperial powers, an idea that it has a kind of precarious existence. So to assert the rootedness, the 1,000 years of history of Iraq as a nation is clearly one way of getting around that. But the other aspect of Iraqi nationalism that he's been very keen on emphasizing is the importance of obeying a single powerful leader. So when he waxes poetic about the 5,000-year-old history of Iraq, he's actually often talking about characters such as Sargon or Nebuchadnezzar or other great autocrats of the past. And clearly he sees himself as a successor to those powerful tyrants of the Mesopotamian Valley.
If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Charles Tripp, and he teaches at the University of London. His book, A History of Iraq, has just been published in a new updated edition. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Charles Tripp, is the author of A History of Iraq. He's also the author of a book about the Iran-Iraq War, which ended 3 years before the Gulf War of 1991. The Iran-Iraq War lasted around 8 years and a very, very bloody war. Did that affect Saddam's standing in the Arab world and how Muslims saw him? Because here he was going to war against a Muslim country.
The effect of the Iran-Iraq war in the Arab world generally is quite interesting. I think that for many of the Gulf states and for others that had no sympathy with the new regime in Iran, there was a good deal of sympathy and support for Iraq and for Saddam Hussein's line that Iraq was effectively protecting the Arab world against Iran. The fact that he had invaded Iran in 1980 was rather glossed over. But there was this notion that if he hadn't done it then, the Iranians would have come over the border. So there was this notion that Saddam and Iraq were defending the Arab world against the religious fanatics, as they were often portrayed in the Iranian case. And also, of course, there was a sectarian element, that is, of the majority Sunni Arab community in the Middle East, seeing the Shi'i Muslims of Iran as being a national enemy, but also to some extent a sectarian enemy. And that got very joined together in some ways in their view of the threat posed by Iran. So I think in the early days, he was viewed as, to some extent, the person who would protect the Arab world from this threat to the East. There were others who didn't buy that line, most obviously the Syrian government, which allied itself promptly with Iran, largely because it didn't get on with the government in Baghdad. But by and large, many swallowed the line that he was indeed defending the Arab world against Islamic reaction.
Let's skip ahead to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in 1990, which kicks off the Gulf War. What were Saddam Hussein's motivations in invading Kuwait?
Well, to some extent, the invasion of Kuwait was a result of the Iran-Iraq war, that during the war against Iran, many Arab states, the Gulf states, the rich ones, had been very willing to support the Iraqi war effort, had lent huge amounts of money and given huge amounts of money to Iraq. When the war ended and the Iranian threat seemed to have passed, they became rather less sympathetic to Saddam Hussein and to Iraq, and so began to press for the repayment of debts and for the contribution that he could make to giving back some of the oil that they had shipped out on his behalf during the war. So by 1990, Saddam Hussein, far from being the hero of the Arab world, looked like the debtor, and he was to a large degree bankrupt. The Iraqi state had built up enormous debts, had huge costs of reconstruction, and that the great victory proclaimed in the ending of the war in 1988 wasn't quite as much of a victory as all that. So the invasion of Kuwait was an attempt by Saddam Hussein to make up for that, both in terms of military prowess, but also purely on economic grounds. He thought that this would be a ploy whereby he could recover the billions that he now owed through some kind of arrangement with Saudi Arabia and perhaps with Kuwait itself.
So he thought that he would, like, take over the oil in Kuwait?
Well, it's all been a bit unclear until Saddam writes his memoirs exactly what he was after in detail. It's quite difficult to tell. But I think there's a strong thesis which argues that the capture of Kuwait was, in a sense, the first move in a game with Saudi Arabia. He didn't want to capture Saudi Arabia's oil wells, but what he wanted to do was basically to be paid to withdraw from Kuwait. The business about Kuwait being an eternal part of the Iraqi nation came rather later, although it's always been in the background in Iraqi political history, but it's not something that many Iraqis subscribe to or think that their country should do much about. But the notion, in other words, that if you write off my debts, if you pay for the reconstruction of Iraq after the war, then I shall withdraw from Kuwait. That was, I think, in the early weeks or after the invasion, was something that Saddam thought was seriously possible.
And then the Gulf War started and he realized it wasn't going to happen that way.
Yes, he made a terrible miscalculation, of course, in the fact that he hoped, and some of his allies in the Arab world, that the occupation of Kuwait would be amenable to what was called then the Arab solution. And the Arab solution was basically to keep the Western powers out of it, to do a deal effectively with Saudi Arabia, to make it worth Iraq's while to withdraw from Kuwait, and on terms that Iraq would dictate in financial terms. Of course, what he discovered was that in occupying Kuwait and expelling its government, that he had effectively wiped a member of the United Nations off the map. And this was no longer simply an Arab affair, but became an affair both of the international community and, of course, of the Western interests that seemed to be at stake in the Kuwaiti economy and its oil fields.
Let's skip ahead to the present. The United States is preparing to go to war against Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein because of his weapons of mass destruction. What kind of shape is Saddam Hussein in now? Is he as powerful now as he was in 91?
Ironically, domestically or within Iraq itself, he is probably more powerful than he was in 1991. One of the effects of sanctions, which I think was clearly not envisaged at the time, was they've actually strengthened the kind of regime that he runs in Iraq. This may seem odd and perverse, but in many ways that has been the outcome. In military terms, of course, he's much weaker. The conventional armed forces of Iraq are not only smaller, but the nature of their weaponry has been degraded over 10 years. And although he's tried to buy spare parts from here and there, in terms of the major refitting or modernization of his armed forces, it's been a very limited affair. So his conventional armed forces are much weaker. And also in terms of his weapons of mass destruction, whatever the United Nations believes he still retained when they left in 1998 and what he may have achieved or tried to acquire since 1998, it's clearly nothing by comparison with what the weapons inspectors found there in 1991. So one could argue that in military terms, as a threat to the region, as a threat to world security, he's much weaker than he was in 1990, 1991. Politically, he's somewhat stronger.
How did sanctions end up strengthening him politically within his own country?
One of the reasons, I think, was that when sanctions are imposed upon a regime like that of Iraq, there's an assumption somehow that they put pressure on the people and the people will put pressure on the government. Of course, in a regime like that of Iraq has always operated on the basis of a sanctions regime deployed against its own people. It's always decided who gets favors, who doesn't, who is excluded, who gets access to resources and who doesn't. And before 1990, the Iraqi people did suffer under a sanctions regime, which was effectively operated by Saddam Hussein and his coterie to decide which parts of the Iraqi population would have good things and which would be deprived of things. After 1990, of course, they suffered under two sanctions regimes, a regime imposed from the outside and the one that continued from within. And I think one of the things that Saddam Hussein has managed to do during the 1990s is to put all the blame for the deprivations of the Iraqi people on the outside world, on the United States, on Britain, on the United Nations Security Council. And for many Iraqis, therefore, when they look at their pretty miserable standard of life, they do not blame necessarily Saddam Hussein, as they might easily have done before 1990. They rather blame the outside world.
Charles Tripp is the author of A History of Iraq. He teaches at the University of London. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, publisher of And Justice There Is None, a Kincaid and James detective novel by Deborah Crombie, author of A Finer End. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the CD we're listening to now, Diaspora Blues, by trumpeter and composer Stephen Bernstein. And we continue our conversation with historian Charles Tripp and consider how the world might change if the U.S. invades Iraq. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with historian Charles Tripp, author of A History of Iraq. He's also the author of books about the Iran-Iraq War and Saudi Arabia. He teaches at the University of London. We've been talking about the history of Iraq and the Bush administration's plans to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Let's pick up where we left off. Now, you're saying that from what you perceive, Saddam's military and his weapons of mass destruction program are much diminished since the first Gulf War. So would you challenge the Bush administration's statements that his weapons of mass destruction are such a threat that we must go in there right now and destroy them?
I think that the present administration, which may be talking about the need to overthrow the regime in Iraq in order to disarm Iraq, has to answer a particular question: is why now? What makes it so threatening at this moment? And I think that in many ways, when one's heard the present administration talking about preemptive strikes, when one's heard it talking about we must do it before it becomes a danger, they're clearly not basing their argument for the change of regime on what Iraq presently has. I think in terms of its missile capabilities and its weapons of mass destruction, it clearly has very little that it can do damage with. It's largely basing it on two kinds of supposition. The first is that within a number of years, it will have acquired much more long-range missiles, much more effective chemical and biological weapons, and possibly a nuclear capability. And that, of course, to some extent conjectural, because we don't know whether they would be able to do that. And they're also basing it on the supposition that once they have them, they will use them in some kind of aggressive and radical way. And again, I think one has to be quite wary of that supposition, too.
Because Saddam Hussein is a ruthless and brutal dictator, I think that there are parts of the Bush administration who assume that if the U.S. military goes in, that there will be parts of the military and maybe other Saddam Hussein insiders who will side with the United States against Saddam Hussein. Do you have any reading on that, about whether we can expect any of the military to defect and change sides?
It's a difficult thing to predict. I think the nature of internal opposition in Iraq, particularly within the military, is something that you cannot tell until it's come out in the open, most usually in the last 20 years, to be purged and executed. But clearly, in the circumstances of an American invasion of Iraq, there is a possibility that sections of the armed forces will turn on Saddam Hussein and overthrow his regime. Some would argue that that is what part of the administration hopes for very fervently. That is the overthrow of the regime in Baghdad by people within the circles of power itself, therefore removing the need for America to occupy the whole of the country or to be seen to be simply removing a foreign government. But of course, it also places a kind of dilemma, which I think others in the administration are quite aware of, is the fact that the people who unseat Saddam, who have the power to do so, and who are well placed to do so, are very much like Saddam. They're not necessarily as ruthless as he at the moment, but their worldview isn't necessarily very different to that of Saddam Hussein himself. And so they will then face a dilemma in the American administration of, well, do we leave power in Iraq in the hands of these generals who have actually been the mainstay of Saddam Hussein's regime over the last 15, 20 years and simply go away? Or do we carry out these more ambitious objectives of bringing a more liberal, open and democratic society into existence in Iraq?
You've studied Saddam Hussein. You've studied his inner circle and his family. One of the things he's famous for is hiding out because he knows he has a lot of enemies. How difficult do you think he would be to find if we do go in there looking to overthrow him?
I think if the Americans or outside forces think that they can simply assassinate him, I think that would be really tricky. I think he knows Iraq much better than anybody on the outside and being able to pin him down. So the notion of sending in a kind of elite force to simply isolate and remove him is, I think, fraught with danger, and you'd only have to be by the purest chance that they actually got hold of him. However, if the Americans and their allies, such as they are at the time, invade Iraq and occupy Baghdad, then there's very little question of Saddam Hussein simply disappearing, rather like Osama bin Laden or Mullah Omar in Afghanistan. I think he would be tracked down very quickly.
You think he would be tracked down quickly?
I think he would, because in many ways, if America was in full occupation of the whole country, then there'd be very little interest, I think, amongst many Iraqis to remain loyal to Saddam Hussein, because his power depends upon state power. And once the state has been torn away from him, he has no power. And for many Iraqis, they would be very willing to turn him in if it meant escaping the retribution of America themselves.
The Bush administration says that the United States should overthrow Saddam Hussein because of weapons of mass destruction and because in this era of terrorism, Saddam Hussein poses a grave threat. Do you think there are other geopolitical reasons why the Bush administration might want to overthrow Saddam Hussein?
Well, I think quite a number of Iraqis, and I rather sympathize with them, tend to think that Iraq may be a means to an end, that certainly weapons of mass destruction is a concern. Certainly the tyranny of Saddam Hussein is a concern. Certainly his record has been pretty diabolical in terms of his actions upon his neighbors. But they can't help feeling that there must be a reason why this is happening now in the wake of the 11th of September as things are unraveling on the Israel-Palestine side. And so many people have interpreted this more as an assertion of American power. In other words, they tend to see some in the administration as looking upon regime change in Iraq as effectively a measure whereby America will impose its order on the Middle East for some years to come. It'll keep Iran terrified that it's next on the list. It'll remind the Saudis that they're not the only oil producers. And some would argue it will force the Palestinians and the Syrians to realize that they have no option other than to deal with Israel as supported by the United States at the moment. So I think many people tend to regard the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, the imposition of a new regime more friendly to the United States in Iraq itself, as being part of a larger strategic plan, at least for some in the administration.
Now, what would it mean for the future of world oil if the United States invades Iraq and overthrows Saddam Hussein? What are the possible outcomes in terms of oil?
I suppose the oil question always comes up quite clearly. Iraq is perhaps the second largest oil reservoir in the Middle East, perhaps in the world after Saudi Arabia. And I think that there's clearly the immediate fear of a war on oil supplies and the price of oil, and therefore the kind of jitters that the oil market seems to periodically go through, even when objectively, as one might say, there's little reason for it to be too jittery. But in the long term, I think that, and this is the irony of it in some ways, whether Saddam Hussein is in power or not, Iraq will need to sell its oil and people will need to buy it. And the logic of the oil market, the energy market, will dictate really the importance of Iraqi oil in the world. So in that sense, I would not agree with those who believe that the planned invasion of Iraq is all about oil. I think oil has its own dynamic, its own market, and oil consumers can deal just as well with Saddam Hussein, who's eager to sell it to them, as they can deal with anyone else.
What do you think the invasion of Iraq would be about?
I think there is an element here within the administration, it seems, of two different visions of America in the world. And I think one of them does correspond to this idea of looking at the 11th of September and reading it not as a result of resentment of the misuse of American power in the Middle East, but rather looking at it as a lapsing of American deterrence in the Middle East, and therefore an argument which says that if America asserted itself more, then groups like Al-Qaeda would not dare and would not have the opportunity to do the kind of things they did on the 11th of September last year. And I think there is a kind of, for want of a better word, imperial logic here, which is to assert power when you have it and to use it very starkly. And one can certainly hear that within the administration when they talk about Iraq. So it's less, in other words, to do about weapons of mass destruction as such than to do with making an example of states that dare to defy the most powerful state in the world by developing weapons of mass destruction and threatening to use them in a way which may be harmful to their interests. So I think there's that side to it. But there also seems to be another vision of America in the world, which comes through in some of the pronouncements of people in the administration. This is a belief that the end of tyranny, the introduction of more open markets and liberal democratic regimes is in the end the best way of securing a world that America can live securely with. And so there is again a more, I think, ideological and less perhaps crudely imperial view here, which is about the using Iraq as a way of establishing a more democratic, a more open order, and serving notice on many of the authoritarian regimes in the Middle East, but perhaps beyond the Middle East as well, that America will not shrink from using force to change the political arrangements across the world.
My guest is Charles Tripp, author of A History of Iraq. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Charles Tripp is my guest. He's a professor of history at the University of London. He's written extensively about Iraq and Saddam Hussein. His latest book, A History of Iraq, has just been published in a new edition. What are some of the unintended consequences you think a war with Iraq might have?
I think there are two that the United States must be very wary of. One is that a war with Iraq, which leads to American entanglement in Iraqi politics in terms of trying to reconstruct a polity in Iraq, trying to protect that polity, trying to bring it out as a viable entity that somehow is supportive of America, is of course fraught with danger. It's fraught with danger in the sense that there are many within Iraq who would be deeply hostile to that vision. There'd be many in the region who'd be deeply hostile to the region and so to the vision. And I think that for the Americans, what they'd have to ask themselves is, do we have the same staying power? Do we have the same stamina as the locals, either the locals in Iraq or the locals in the region? The example there, I suppose, is Lebanon in the 1980s when America intervened. But of course, the Lebanese and the Syrians and others had far greater staying power and to some extent ruthlessness, and ensured that the Americans left, abandoning the attempt to recreate the state or the polity of Lebanon. So I think that's clearly one of the unintended consequences, which is a painful, open-ended engagement with forces with which the Americans are perhaps ill-equipped to cope or will cost them more than they think is worth, and then perhaps an ignominious withdrawal. The other, obviously, is the other thesis about the 11th of September, which is that events such as this, recruitment for al-Qaeda, thrives upon conditions whereby it can be portrayed that America is at war in some way with the Islamic or the Arab worlds. And clearly, therefore, there is a fear that a war against Iraq will provide an excellent recruiting ground for the next wave of al-Qaeda.
Of course, the most frightening scenario is that the U.S. invades Iraq with or without allies. And this is the first strike in what later develops into World War III. What do you think the odds of that are?
I don't think there's anyone out there who can really launch World War III in a conventional sense or a non-conventional sense against America. So some have argued, and again, one has to be wary about swallowing all the rhetoric, that the war on terrorism is a kind of World War III. This has often been portrayed as such. And what one's looking at then is war not in the conventional sense, but in the sense of the powerless using what violence they can against the powerful in unexpected places and often with devastating results. So clearly, if the invasion of Iraq leads not necessarily next year or within 6 months, but perhaps in 5 years' time, to precisely the sort of event one saw in New York last year in September, then clearly the Americans have sown the seeds or will have sown the seeds of something that they will find difficult to control by conventional means. And the question there is, how well equipped are the Americans still to deal with such a non-conventional war?
What's happening in your country? It looks like Tony Blair's in a big minority in wanting to join with the United States in invading Iraq.
I think the public is rather confused. Today, there is a debate in Britain about the wisdom of supporting the American line. And clearly, the British government is trying to make an argument which suggests that the acquisition or intention to acquire weapons of mass destruction by the Iraqi regime is sufficient grounds for intervention. But I think many in this country question whether it's sufficient grounds for war. I think many share the government's concern and the American government's concern about the development of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But I don't think that many support the notion that one should go to war to cure it. I think for many, the perception is that for the last 10 years, deterrence and containment has largely worked. Saddam Hussein is not regarded as a threat by its regional, most of its regional neighbours, and in many ways is a much reduced power. And I think many also look at the way Saddam Hussein has organised himself and see a rather third-rate, third-world power, and find it quite baffling to know why, again, this has built up in the way it has at the moment. So I don't think people are unconcerned about the development of weapons of mass destruction. I think what people are concerned about is whether going to war, with all the unforeseen consequences that might bring up in its trail, quite apart from the immediate deaths of Iraqis and others that it will cause, whether this is really the best way of going about deterring and containing the Iraqi capacity to develop weapons of mass destruction.
I'd like to close with a question that isn't one of the weightier questions that are facing us right now. But, you know, every time I see a photograph in the newspaper of Saddam Hussein surrounded by his inner circle, it looks like Saddam Hussein with a room full of Saddam Hussein lookalikes. They're not only dressed like he is in the same military uniform with the hat, they have the same haircut and they have the same mustache.
Well, it's certainly true that in political systems based upon the powerful personality of one person, many of those around him want to look like him because they imitate the way he dresses. They see this as the sincerest form of flattery. And one can never have too much flattery when you're around Saddam Hussein. And I think for many, this is a way of doing it. Of course, the other side of that is that many of the people around Saddam Hussein come from his background, and therefore it's not really surprising they look rather like him. Many of them are related to him or come from very much the same community in Iraq from which he comes from. So there are all sorts of reasons why I think that has developed, leading to, of course, all the wonderful stories about doubles and trebles and various versions of Saddam Hussein that crop up in the press.
How much is the mustache an Iraqi tradition, and how much of it is Saddam Hussein lookalike?
Oh, no, it's very much an Iraqi peasant tradition.
Okay.
And at the same time, it's also regarded as a very masculine tradition, not just in Iraq. I mean, I think if one looked in many other countries in the Middle East, there's a very similar importance for a certain idea of masculinity, of growing your moustache in as bristling and as aggressive a way as possible.
If he asked, what advice would you give President Bush?
I suppose the advice that one would want to give him is to think whether he can achieve the same objectives without war. I think that a war on Iraq leads to many unforeseen consequences. If President Bush and his administration has a very clear idea of what it is they want to achieve beyond the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, and if they have a realistic idea about how that can be achieved inside Iraqi society, they have to ask whether the use of war to achieve that will actually undermine those achievements. So, again, what one has to ask is, have you got your priorities right? Is it really about the elimination of weapons of mass destruction, in which case is war necessarily the best way of doing it? Or is it about the construction of a more open, liberal regime in Iraq? And again, one has to ask, is war with large numbers of Iraqi and possibly American casualties and the installation of a client regime in Baghdad necessarily the best way of going about it?
Charles Tripp, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Charles Tripp is the author of A History of Iraq. A new updated edition has been published. He teaches at the University of London. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Diaspora Blues, the new CD by trumpeter and composer Stephen Bernstein. This is Fresh Air. The combination of jazz and Jewish music is nothing new. In the 1930s, trumpeter Ziggy Elman brought klezmer inflections and at least one Jewish melody to Benny Goodman's band, and even Cab Calloway recorded an impression of a cantor's cantillations. Mixing the two became a full-blown trend in New York in the early 1990s, when some downtown musicians started presenting concerts and recording CDs under the rubric Radical Jewish Culture. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says some of that music hasn't sounded very radical or very good, but one new CD vindicates the concept.
Trumpeter Stephen Bernstein's new CD, Diaspora Blues, was inspired by Moshe Kusevitzky, a legendary cantor from Warsaw who survived the Holocaust to become a prominent figure in New York's Jewish community. Some of his rhythmically and melodically intricate chants were captured on record, which is where Bernstein discovered them. Four of the pieces on his new album uses transcriptions of Kusevitzky as springboards for improvising, where the players observe the same modes or scales the cantor used riffing on the same material. At 40, Bernstein is a veteran of downtown groups like the Lounge Lizards, Spanish Fly, and his own Sex Mob. He has a focused, vocalized approach to trumpet, which is perfect for this project. Sometimes he also uses a plunger mute or the rare slide trumpet to sound even more voice-like. Stephen Bernstein's masterstroke was to record these pieces with musicians from way outside his circle, the Orlando-based trio of the African-American saxophonist and flutist Sam Rivers. He's a longtime hero of Bernstein's and an old hand at constructing meaty solos over minimal or open-ended structures like these. His heavier sound makes his tenor a perfect foil for trumpet. This is from one of the Kusevitzky pieces. Sam Rivers has been working with the same rhythm section since he moved to Florida a decade ago, and they sound exceptionally good under Stephen Bernstein's leadership. Bassist Doug Matthews and drummer Anthony Cole also double on bass clarinet and tenor saxophone, which lets the band briefly morph into a wind quartet. It's curious that the loose unisons the horn players play and the deep reverb on the recorded sound are clichés of the German label ECM, whose aesthetic is rarely associated with Jewish soul. But here that echo does enhance the music's open texture and puts you in the sacred resonant space of a temple. Stephen Bernstein somehow folds free jazz and the Old Testament into one tradition. Now that's radical Jewish culture. By happy coincidence, a 1963 album that looked forward to that movement has just been reissued. Terry Gibbs plays Jewish melodies in jazz time. Mixed musicians from the Vibraphonist Jazz Group and his brother Saul Gage's Jewish band for a program of old and new tunes that doesn't take itself all too seriously. Let's go out with a bit of Terry Gibbs's Pretty and Sweet.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed Diaspora Blues by Stephen Bernstein and the reissue Jewish Melodies in Jazz Time by Terry Gibbs. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Aveda, maker of sustainably sourced hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Keith Bratcher, author of High and Mighty, SUVs, the World's Most Dangerous Vehicles, and How They Got That Way. Also, novelist Rohinton Mistry discusses his new book, Family Matters. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.